Okay, so we're all here for the panel on the Solange. No, no, wait there. Yeah. Man, backdoor encryptions and the Australian law nonsense, in many ways. Let me just start on your moderator, Gitech. Most of you here, if you've been regulars here for the past 10 years, you should recognize me. I used to man that desk to the side a lot. I now wander around moving funnily in front of cameras and stuff. But, I'm a tech researcher. I work for Torrent Freak. I've also written for Tech Dirt, Ars Technica, and a few other places. So I handle a lot of the cryptography side. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a robotics engineer turned general dog's body. So, Alice?
My name is Amy. I am a lawyer, but as the sign to your right says, that does not matter because nothing I say is legal advice. And as Kurt said a little while ago, if it was, you'd get a bill. I am newly, as of exactly
2 weeks ago?
4.5 weeks ago, the executive director of Silicon Flatirons, which is a tech policy convener and think tank at the University of Colorado School of Law. So I am new in Boulder, Colorado. If anybody lives or is from there, please give me tips and advice because I don't know anything outside my apartment at this point. But we do this is not a lie. I just have boxes. That's all I know. We do a lot of convenings. We work with entrepreneurs in the area and across the country and try to get students educated and placed within the tech sector. And I also, in a previous life, where I spoke here for the last 4 years in the capacity, worked at Access Now, among other things, on all things Australia. So I can talk to you about all of the different ways that we're not after dark yet, are we? So I'll watch my language. About all the different ways Australia has done bad things for the internet.
All right. Hello, everybody, and thank you for coming. My name is Kurt Opsahl. I'm the Deputy Executive Director and General Counsel at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to defending your rights online. Next year will be our 30th year. So it was founded in 1990. We've been involved in the fight to preserve strong encryption for quite a while. Actually, in the 90s, what we now call Crypto Wars Part 1, there was a lot of strong efforts to make a weaker encryption. It was mandated for a while that export versions of software have weak encryption that was easy for governments to break and get a hold of. And so there was like a domestic and export version of the Netscape Navigator. Netscape Navigator layer went on to become, Firefox. We fought on this on free speech grounds, that code is speech and the ability to publish strong encryption was protected by the First Amendment. That was successful, and so you could export strong crypto. And there were other attempts. There was something called the Clipper chip, which was a chip that was going to go into phones that would have a key escrow system, and so that was their idea of a good backdoor. The key escrow, the design was that it would have encrypted communications, but there'd be an extra key to that would be held in a supposedly secure manner. And then when the government came knocking, then they could get the key and see the messages. And then it turned out that the Clipper chip was bad in two ways. One is that you could send messages and encrypt them without putting the key into a way that the government get it. And second is someone other than the government could get the key if you did have a key. So they withdrew that in shame. Then for a while things seemed to be quiet. But they've revved up again after the interbellum, and so we're in the Crypto Wars Part 2.
World Crypto Wars.
Exactly.
Crypto World War.
Crypto World War the second. The Empire Strikes Back. So, they're striking back, trying to go against encryption, and so that is going to be our topic for today, in particular about Australia, though there are other countries that are also fighting against encryption, especially countries like Australia that are in the Five Eyes, the five intelligence services of UK, US, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia.
Most recently, Bill Barr, Attorney General Bill Barr, wanting to push it, what was that, a month ago?
Oh, yes.
A month ago.
And he said a bit of the quiet part out loud, actually, which was that he didn't care if it was going to be a problem. And then General Hayden, who used to be retired from being the head of the NSA, tweeted in response to that saying, like, yes, it is a problem, which is sort of, you know, a relatively unusual thing to see the head of the NSA pushing for stronger encryption and pushing back against U.S. policy on that. But that is because it is, in fact, a really bad idea.
Okay. So let's start off. Does everybody here know what encryption is?
Yeah. There we go.
Anybody who doesn't?
You're a liar. Nathan used to work with me. He knows what encryption is.
Oh, is that Nathan? I didn't recognize him without his clear rain suit. Okay, so basically, you know, encryption is a way of encoding something or hiding something in a way that makes it non-obvious and non-visible, put it most simple. There's a good physical analogy, and that's a padlock. A lot of encryption. You have a key, you put it in, and if you have the right key, the lock unlocks. How many people flew here to this convention? How many of you used a TSA padlock to close that suitcase? A little padlock with a little red diamond on it. Do you know what that red diamond means?
It's a weak padlock.
Well, it means that it's a TSA-approved padlock, which means it has a TSA back door. So there are seven keys for travel padlocks that the TSA has master keys to. They can unlock those padlocks. Which is a great idea in theory. It's a back door for the padlock.
Well, except that other people can get through those padlocks rather easily, and I think the TSA has published pictures of the keys from which you could rather easily derive the key pattern.
And that's the problem, because then people can make their own keys, and therefore, all of a sudden, this secret backdoor key is now public. So therefore, the lock is only good for not letting your zippers move.
A funny thing about that, as I sold it, that you're not allowed to use those when transporting firearms on a plane.
That's true.
Because they recognize, at least with those, okay, we don't want to have the insecure rock. For everyone else, there's this thing, but...
You have to provide your phone number. Padlock your case. It
into the microphone.
It cannot be opened in any way. It cannot open a millimeter.
So this,
I've been through this.
This is an important thing, and it's a thing you're going to hear from the law enforcement side of this conversation. So I'm going to, this is not my argument. I'm going to say that again. This is not my argument. But what the TSA locks do is they keep the opportunist or the unprepared potential bad guy out of your suitcase. What potentially insecure encryption might do, backdoored encryption, and what the FBI thinks that they could do with backdoored encryption is get to the dumb criminal. Get to the person who is not preparing to have that encryption
broken.
And then they can see those communications and go after them. The problem is, and this is my argument, is that we're changing the way we see technology. We're advancing. Technology is always getting... The technology you have in your pocket now is probably much more advanced than the technology you had in your pocket 5 years ago. Does everybody agree with that? The things that you know about technology now are probably more advanced than the things that you knew about technology 5 years ago. That's true for criminals, too. And once upon a time, there were cars, and it was not probably criminal best practice to know how to hotwire a car right after cars came out. Very shortly, that probably did become best practice. Encryption is just going to become, and knowing how to use the not backdoored encryption is going to become standard best practice for criminals. And so really what the FBI and other law enforcement is talking about is making insecure communications equipment that will be used by all of you, but not by the criminals.
I think another thing that backdoored or widely backdoored encryption is good for is for mass surveillance, where you're not looking for a particular person, but you're looking for indicia by monitoring lots of communication of something going, whatever keywords you're looking for. And so you're not trying to find a person, you're not trying to investigate a crime, but you're trying to do pre-crime. And you know, we know that the NSA has been working on that for a long time in the sort of post 9/11, wanting to look at all sorts of internet communications, analyzing them with computers and trying to sniff out the traffic they're interested in. And so that's really much harder to do if all of it is encrypted. And if you wanted to target a particular person, they actually have lots of techniques for targeting particular people. Network intrusion trolls, you know, good old phishing.
Network intrusion tools.
Yeah, NITs.
Hacking.
Hacking. Well, I mean, typically, yeah, network intrusion trolls is the FBI government euphemism for putting malware on your machine, hacking. And they usually just do it by sending a phishing email. People click on the link or open the attachment, as people do all the time. And voila, they're on your computer. And if you have end-to-end encryption, but they own one of the endpoints, then they're in. So they're like, the investigations are not being prevented from doing this, with absent a few like rare circumstances. So as you can see, this panel, not a big fan of the back doors.
No. So should we start with the Australian law itself, right, or the proposal from the Australian?
Oh no, it's law.
It's a law.
Well, yeah.
So around Christmas time, how many people are paying attention to what happens in
tech news?
Not even the U.S. Congress, but a foreign legislative body around Christmas time. Yeah, that's about right.
Not all of you?
They bet on that. They know this. So in December, the Australian Parliament passed, under the scare tactic that there might be some sort of attack that happens and they need to have this authority right away, because if they don't, Australians are in grave danger.
Blood will be on your hands.
Blood will be on your hands. They passed what is called, this should be after dark, the Assistance and Access Law, which has been very creatively abbreviated. I will let you all come up with
access.
With what that is in your heads. And what does that law do? It is the law. They are reviewing it right now. So if any of you have Australian legislative contacts, this is the time to reach out, because there might be a way to fix it. It does a few things. It basically says certain law enforcement or intelligence agencies in Australia can ask essentially any company, wherever it's located in the world, to do essentially anything. And now the companies are enumerated, the types of companies are enumerated, the types of things are enumerated, but what it comes down to is basically any company that can be used in Australia. So if you have a website that's accessible on the internet, can do basically anything, because what they can order companies to do is so broad, it encompasses all things. That law can be also, foreign countries can ask Australia to use that law for them, so long as they are asking for what the foreign country describes as serious crime. And so if Saudi Arabia or the United States or Russia wanted Australia to order a company to do something under this law, that is allowed. There is no transparency. In fact, the gag provisions are so broad that a law firm in Australia said that companies cannot even say if they have not been asked to do anything under the law. So you can't say if you have been, you can't say if you haven't been, you can't basically talk about it at all. And you're never going to know if it gets used.
Yeah. And that's especially important. Who's paying attention to what's happening in Hong Kong right now? It's, if you think, you know, that's exactly where this kind of law will be used, because especially Hong Kong's proximity to Australia.
So yeah, it's fairly nefarious. I mean, it's one of the worst. I mean, one of the things that came out earlier on in some of the debates around here, the Prime Minister said that when people said he was asking for something that violated the laws of mathematics with his strong encryption that still is backdoored, said the laws of mathematics don't apply in Australia. And, you know, that's not I don't know how that works. And this has actually been part of a push amongst other countries. Also, the United Kingdom has passed the Investigatory Powers Act, which also had a lot of backdooring provisions. Australia is pretty scary about this, you know, with provisions that it would allow them to talk to engineers and put pressure on individuals, which can be an extraordinarily scary experience. And some provisions about providing advice to people who are potentially going to be asked by the government. So it's not good. It raises some interesting questions for companies who believe in having strong encryption. Like, okay, of course, it says it applies worldwide, but there is sort of like, well, the what you going to do about it problem. If you don't have any offices or people in Australia, you don't have any sort of physical presence there, it will be tough for Australia to enforce this law against you.
But you better not ever plan on going there.
But don't plan your next vacation to be the Great Barrier Reef. That's an interesting question that will happen for some companies. Like, you know, Apple has said very strongly that they refused a backdoor, that they, you know, they fought against the U.S. government trying to get backdoors and to weaken the security. It came up in the San Bernardino terrorism case. So will they continue to do business in Australia? Or just be satisfied that people can go get their Apple products by taking a trip to Singapore? So I hope that puts some pressure on Australia to reconsider their ill-advised move. Though one of the things that would make the greatest pressure on it, they've tried to subvert by this gag provision, so you can't tell if it has ever happened.
Are there any Australians in the audience?
Nope.
That's a thing. So Australia is the only Five Eyes member without a Bill of Rights, which means it's largely considered by people to be the weakest Five Eyes member. And this encryption law, censorship law, is just really bad piece of legislation, is really the latest way that Australia has hurt tech. They have passed, I think, just started working at Access 6 years ago, what they call the terror laws, which included mandatory data retention. It was a really, really interesting piece where one of the political people got up and said, "We don't want to know what websites you're visiting. We only want to know your metadata." And it was like a 5-minute video clip where he's like, "We just want your metadata. We don't want to know what you're doing. We just want your metadata." And it clearly didn't understand what metadata was, but thought it was a catch-all provision for it's not going to do anything to invade your privacy. They have implemented a lot of programs, most recently a program called My Health Record, that have collected lots of information about Australians in a very insecure fashion, and used it for a variety of purposes. And they're currently undergoing what's called the Digital Platforms Inquiry, which is trying to figure out how to regulate what people can say and post on the internet. As well as doing really good things like talking about privacy online and how to regulate what information companies can keep and retain about you. So that has a double-edged piece to it, where there's a good side and a bad side. So this is one of the more recent ones. And to get into the political structure there, the side of the political party that opposed this law decided to cave in December, as I said, because of scare tactics, but they got this reservation in the law saying we're going to review it early in 2019 and see if we can change it. And that's because they thought they were going to win the Australian elections in 2019. And all of the polls said that side was going to win the Australian elections. Now, what happened the last time US polls said one party was going to win?
Or UK polls, or New Zealand polls.
So the other party won, and they have decided this law is just going to stay in place and they're really not going to do much about it, even though this review is ongoing. So a lot of people are writing and commenting and asking for it to be reviewed and repealed, but it's very unlikely because of the fact that the opposing party didn't win the election that anything is going to happen to it. So we have a really bad law on the books, and it's on the books for the foreseeable future, and it's able to be used internationally. And it can cause disastrous consequences for digital security.
And I think in also being used internationally, keep in mind that the Five Eyes share intelligence amongst each other so that they can, Australia can use these powers to gather intelligence that might be not available to other members of the Five Eyes and then share it with that member, which creates a possibility of sort of working around the bills of rights that exist within the other Five Eyes.
And checks and balances such as the domestic spying restrictions for, say, the US. So why spy on yourself, which you're not allowed to, and you can just ask your good buddy to spy on your domestic people instead?
Are consumers allowed any sort of notification when their data is? No.
None.
No.
If the companies can't even say that they're not being notified, there's no way that's going to,
it's super gag orders.
Yeah.
Can I step in for some prerogative to do what I did earlier today? This has been a really depressing conversation, and that room has just been freaking happy all day, and it's irritating.
Science is fun.
Scott and the volunteers here are doing an excellent job. Can we get a huge round of applause and clapping for these people? And let's see what happens. We are a happy room.
I think we should all voice our displeasure at the new laws.
Given the gag rules that are in place, would digital canaries be effective here? And if they would be, do any exist?
Well, so I mean that's essentially that provision saying interpreted at least to mean that you can't say that you didn't get one. That avoids the whole point of a canary, right? The canary is to take advantage of that there's no restriction on saying that you didn't get a piece of process, and then when employed well, you would then later not say anything about whether you did or didn't, and people would infer correctly from the fact that you changed from saying you didn't get one to change to being silent about having gotten one or not. But Australia jumped ahead of that, or at least, again, as interpreted. And I guess on the as interpreted, I mean, it may be that since this law has passed and they've tried to use it and some companies have pushed back and there have been secret court proceedings and interpretations and such, all of that could be happening, but there's no transparency about it. Like, we don't get to see what the legal interpretation is. And I know that from some aspects of the U.S. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is a secret court for getting orders about surveilling inside the United States, there are a lot of problems that arose from it being not transparent, having only one-sided arguments presented by the government about this. Maybe the companies can present their arguments. I don't know how easily they are able to even bring lawyers into it. But secret courts is not a good way to get the best ruling of law. So we'll see what those interpretations actually end up being. Maybe if they get declassified or we get some reform here, but until then, we're in the dark.
In fact, the fact that they're secret should tell you something about how legitimate the people passing it think they actually are. If they can't stand the scrutiny of day, then, why is it that they can be the only one to be secret?
Because they know better than everybody else.
I think so, anyway.
With the success of this legislation, what is the danger of it spreading to other countries similarly? Or do you think they will just try to establish relations with Australia to leverage that?
I mean, I think we see these laws. The IP Act is one of them, and that started in the UK. We're seeing them pop up in different forms in different places. China has its own version of this. Kazakhstan requires what are called national security certificates to be installed on devices. So it's like the Clipper chip original proposal. This is Australia's form, and I think with Bill Barr's comments a month ago that were referenced earlier, you see there might be movement toward this in the US, but was anybody paying attention to the Apple news yesterday coming out of Google?
Yeah.
I think that every time we see disastrous security failures like this, it does provide us a little bit of ammunition against that. But if I'm totally honest, a little bit. If I'm totally honest, I think that we're just going to go through Australia. I don't think the U.S. even needs this anymore. We have what we need because we can use that.
I didn't see what happened with the Apple thing. I was too busy with the wrestling.
Oh, so it turns out that iPhones have a glaring security vulnerability and were totally owned every time you visited one of a few unknown websites. I couldn't figure out what websites they were.
They're deliberately hiding that at this point.
And if you visited those websites, they could get access to your passwords, your communications, They basically owned your endpoint. It went away every time you turned your phone on and off. But how many of you have turned your phone on and off in the last week?
like six times a day. I keep running out of battery.
Oh, well. How many of you purposefully turned your phone on and off in the last week? Okay, this is an abnormal room. So it would go away if you turned your phone on and off until you visited one of those websites again.
They haven't said what the websites were, but indicated that they were an attempt to spy on certain communities. So they were apparently interested in sort of the subject matter that those websites' communities were getting together and talking about. But they were extremely cagey about what this is. This is all up on Google's Project Zero, and they go through the ODAs they found and what they did. And then just a very important thing about this is it kind of makes a little rethinking of your security against zero-day exploits. So these were exploits that you could sell on the black market for millions. There was a theory.
What is a zero-day exploit?
That's a good question. A zero-day exploit is what you call a previously unknown exploit, and on the first day that it becomes known, it is a day one or whatever, and day two thereafter, and so on. When it's a zero day, it is completely unknown as an exploit. And so those are the sort of the most valuable exploits because you sort of the longest window of time being able to use them before they get patched, and then people are unable to be affected by them, or at least if they update their phones regularly. And iPhone has pretty strong security, so that's why there's sort of a high price for a zero-day on an iPhone. But for whoever did this, instead of what we had thought was it would mostly be used for when you had $1 million, like care about somebody, a target that you're willing to spend $1 million on, you'd burn an O-day. O-day, another term for zero-day. But this is going after a community of people trying to sort of get the most bang for their buck with this exploit, and there were five different exploits. So on the plus side, that also means that now those things are being patched, and if they had been used elsewhere, those zero days are burned. But it is a pretty scary thing. I also wanted to, just jumping back to what you said about Kazakhstan, one thing I did appreciate is that some of the browser companies were reacting to Kazakhstan's attempt to require a bad certificate. The certificate basically allowed them to man in the middle. It was if you had a encrypted communication coming out of Kazakhstan, instead of encrypting it to the website that you were going to, they would man in the middle it, so they encrypt it to them, they would get to see it, then they would send it off to the website you were going to, and then bring the information back, but always be able to see it along the way. And so that was something at least the browsers could do something about. But it does illustrate a problem that's like these things are spreading. And one of the things I think very disturbing about Australia doing this sort of thing, or the UK for that matter, US talking about it, is we often put ourselves out as a rights-abiding, human rights-sensitive style of government, a democracy. Australia may not have a Bill of Rights, but they still say they're a democracy and have these sort of values, and they think it's cool. And so countries that don't have those sort of democratic rights, human rights-based principles, now can start pushing for these kinds of things, which they've wanted all along. And at least as a PR matter, like, hey, well, look, Australia was doing it, the UK is doing it, the US wants to do it. Obviously, this is not infringing on any human rights. And they can go to the companies. If the companies agree and put those backdoors in and say, well, you did it for Australia, why aren't you doing it for us? China could say, we also want these backdoors in every device, and you have to give it to China or Russia. And if they are, if they said yes to any of these countries, then it makes it much harder to say no to the other ones, even if they think they are a regime that will use it for authoritarian purposes and not respect the human rights of its people. And so, even if you do believe these Western democracies are going to be cool about things, it has this negative effect throughout the world.
does anyone know if Australia did a financial study against the impact of their economy before they decided to put this in place? Because I control a federal environment that only the U.S. government is allowed to function in. I have three pieces of software I'm about to rip out of there, and it will also impact my commercial environment because what I push to federal goes to my commercial side. They will be losing every bit of business from a very large company. And that's just one company. I can't imagine what it's going to do to their economy.
That's maths. They don't understand the laws of maths, you know?
I mean, they didn't. There have been two studies I've seen since that have shown negative economic impacts of this law. I don't think they're caring right now. And I was in Australia 3 weeks ago, and I was in a room with really wonderful, influential people and brought up this law, and half of them didn't know what it was. And I think that we have to be a lot louder internationally, especially the business community, talking about not only the existence of this law and the fact that it passed, but the fact that it's not just a terrorism law, it's not just a law to make people safer, it is a law that's having huge economic ramifications and security ramifications. And that Australia's, like, 5 years from now when they're like, why don't we have a tech economy, they're not going to know the answer because they don't think of this law in those terms. And so we have to be changing the way we talk about it and be very loud about exactly this thing because we're seeing it already.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. And I think if more companies were clear that this law meant that Australian software was not trustable, was not that it made it so they were going to affect their purchasing decisions if it was subject to this Australian law, even though you couldn't know whether it was in fact compromised, I think that would send a powerful message. And it may take them a little while to get that message because they don't seem to be set up to receive it. But nevertheless, that's one way you can have an effect.
Who here would think they wouldn't have fallen prey to that Apple thing? They wouldn't have gone to an infected site. Who thinks they would have steered clear by only going to trusted sites?
I mean, for all we know, it was a seemingly trusted site. I mean,
well, I was going to say, what about ad networks? That's one of the easiest ways. Just embed it as a iframe ad through.
So at EFF, we actually had a little bit of experience like this, not with 0 days, but someone registered Electronic Frontier Foundation, all one word, and our website is EFF. And then they put up a watering hole site trying to infect people who passed by. Now, the attack was one that was, if you were patched, you were secure against, but many people don't regularly patch their computers. Totally patch your computers. Do this. If you haven't patched it recently, do it and set it to auto-update. It was just trying to get people who were interested in that subject matter, and they had a copy of our website there, so the people were getting, you know, the content. It seemed to be advertised mostly to the Russian community, we have no way of attributing it directly to the Russian government, but it's hard to see who else would be interested in putting malware on those machines. But like, I wouldn't charge someone with not knowing that electronicfrontierfoundation.org wasn't a real website.
Like, I'd assume so, it. You know, I think you'd put it as a backup.
I don't know on an Android, but Apple, Settings, General, Software Update, check for updates. And if it tells you your software is up to date, you're good. If there's a little red circle with a 1 in it, hit the update button tonight when you plug your phone in.
Unless you have a jailbreak on your phone.
If you want to keep your jailbreak, then you gotta. That makes it very hard to secure, but you hopefully know what you're doing if you've jailbroken your phone. I think it's great if you know what you're doing to be able to have the freedom to use your phone, but there's a lot of knowledge that you need to use to jailbreak and operate effectively.
Let's say I go to vacation in Australia. Someone stalks me on Instagram, not an Australian-based company. They murder me. I want justice from beyond the grave. I know we want to support law enforcement. I know we want to support investigations. Where is that line? And that's what I always struggle with. This is that it seems like it's always kind of an all or nothing.
there has to be a line somewhere to allow law enforcement to do their job, but not put us as a population at risk. So where is that? And if you could recraft the Australian legislation, what would you do?
They say that the UK is you know, a surveillance heavy society, right? Yeah. I mean, London especially is tens of thousands of cameras everywhere. Yeah. So what's the first thing police do nowadays when there's a major crime in the UK? What do you think? Go to the cameras. What don't they do? Look at the actual evidence of the crime. It's the first thing they try to jump ahead to see if they can take a shortcut to miss out the actual evidence and see if there's some kind of grainy picture somewhere that could or could not be, and then you could match a shirt and a pattern and a cut pattern on a shirt or some other absolute Felger cop to see if that, you know. These aren't about doing proper investigative work. It's often about the quickest shortcut so that they can get rid of the case as quick as possible. So this would be instead of doing an investigative system, it's we'll just surveil. Reverse warrants, for example, where they send to Google and say, give me all the people's phones in this area of this crime at this time, and then we'll go through like that.
So I want to address more to the going dark issue, which is how law enforcement phrases it, where they feel like they're going dark and it will impede their investigations. And like this has been a constant theme in trying to say why they need to get access to these encrypted communications. Though it's actually kind of interesting because most of the time they're trying to make an example of why they're going dark. They're talking about encryption on the device, the hard drive on a phone being encrypted so they can't get access to it. But most of the back doors that they're pushing for are encryption in communication methods, which is a different issue. It has different equities at play. Be that as it may, we're living in a golden age of surveillance. So if something unfortunate happened to you in Australia, you know, they'd be able to pull without this law, be able to track where your phone was. They would be able to see at least some metadata about the communications that you have, and only have an encryption problem if you were using an encrypted messenger service. Now, hopefully you would be, because that's how you roll. But Instagram is not, right? When it becomes what's the Insta Messenger, when they put WhatsApp, Instagram, Messenger, and Facebook Messenger all in one, that will be encrypted.
They say. Don't have it yet.
But the investigations were able to be successful throughout many, many aspects of histories where there were inability to get communication. So, for example, we used to have these things called payphones. You can ask your parents. They allowed for communications between people where there was no authentication of who you were. Were able to call any number and then have a communication. And if they didn't already have a wiretap up on that phone, which was unusual, then they could listen. They could not listen into the communications. Nevertheless, during that era, the U.S. Was able to bring down many mafia families who were extremely good at security compared to your average criminal. So I'm not sure that, like, in a golden age of surveillance where they can look at what websites that you visited, where you go on your phone, tracking you, we're tracking other people to get a cell tower dump to see who was in the area at the time that you got attacked, see where they went next, where they can find some evidence on the scene. If they do have pictures, use facial recognition technology. They can go to your phone provider and say, oh, did he have cloud backups? And if it did, maybe they can get your communications that way, unless you did, as you should, turn off cloud backups for your encrypted messages. So there's all these techniques that would enable law enforcement. And their law enforcement, when they were last trying to push against it in the U.S., they said there were like something like 7,000
points of metadata or something.
No, it was encrypted phones that they couldn't get into. And then it turned out they had to make a correction later, and it was like about 1,000 of them, right? So, and this is, 300 million people in the United States. This is not a large percentage of the problems that they have with investigations. At the same time, we have other crimes going on where they remain unsolved, not due to encryption, just because there's backlogs in the crime lab and evidence is left sitting around for 6 months and then like the DNA, you know, gets lost or spoiled. So in terms of things that are preventing effective law enforcement, encryption of communications and encryption of devices is not at the high end of that list. So, I mean, I appreciate that, you know, you would want justice from the grave, but there's a very good chance that you would get justice without this law, and a lot of people would be put in danger with this law. People who are political opponents, opposition activists, there have been so many examples of governments using access to communications to spy outside of the lawful boundaries, to do so for political purposes, to try and suppress other sides. So when Kazakhstan is man in the middling, you know, they are not doing this so they can find out who the murdered person is. They're doing this so they can make sure that their effective dissent, so their dictatorship that has been in place since the fall of the Soviet Union, can continue on in power. So that's where I come from, the going dark.
And just one quick add-on. So many of the investigative techniques that Kurt mentioned as alternatives are alternatives because they themselves are too broad, with not enough civil liberties protections and not enough limitations on how easily law enforcement can get a hold of that information. And you only have to look at the law enforcement relationship in Florida between police offices and the Ring systems. If you haven't seen those news stories, look them up. They're appalling. This story has been developing for the past few months. And we need actually more limitations on how much information law enforcement can have access to, not fewer. And we don't need to be undermining security, as Kurt said. So just, we argue that all of these things are in place, and I think that's right, and we need to. But on the other side, we're also arguing for limitations on a lot of those things, and I think that's right as well.
Yeah, thank you for that ad. And there's also, I want to just hit one more point. Theft of phones was more common before every phone was locked and required passwords or biometrics to open, and the material on it was encrypted, that by putting these security measures on the phone that makes it difficult for law enforcement to get in, it actually is disincentivizing people from stealing your phone and trying to resell it because they can't get in.
Oh, I was wondering, do you think we'll see any of the big names, PayPal, Amazon, any of them try and pull out of Australia because of this new law, or you think they're all going to capitulate?
So first of all, I would love to see some of those big names that you named implement end-to-end encryption on some of their services. That aside, potentially, Kurt mentioned Apple and the fact that they're probably going to be one of the first ones that has a lot of decisions to make. Although I will say Ring, which is owned by Amazon, their terms of service specifically says we can turn over information to law enforcement for any reason. They also say they can push software updates to your phone to increase security or for any other reason at their sole discretion, which could include because we were asked by a foreign government. These are the provisions that if you see in terms of service, not push notification or push updates, which can actually in some cases be quite good and they can keep you secure, make sure your system is up to date and patched. But if they specifically say we can do it not only for the security of your device, but for any other reason, including if we just kind of want to, that's a big red flag to me. And so I would like to see us studying a lot more of what these companies are saying, because I think it signals what they might do in the case of a government order coming to them.
Yeah, the wording of the law seems bizarre to me, but maybe it's common. It sounds like they aggressively put themselves at the service of all foreign governments. But and when you said that, I thought, why are they inviting that? You know, why are they inviting that? Where is that common?
Well, there's actually, it's not as uncommon as you might think. Many countries have what's called a mutual legal assistance treaties, or MLATs. And that is a treaty between...
You just spoiled one of Scott's trivia questions.
Oh, man.
Wait, there's trivia?
I guess so. So now you all know. Come back for trivia and you'll win that question. So an MLAT is a mutual legal assistance treaty, and it sets forth a procedure by which a foreign government can ask for the local government to help them out. And it has some checks and balances in it, actually a fair lot of them. It has to go through, first the State Department takes it in, it goes through the Justice Department, and then if they think it's all cool, then it will go on further. And things they're supposed to look at is whether there's mutuality, which you say, is this something that's also illegal in our country? They are supposed to be looking out for like human rights issues if people are being abusive of it. However, people are all like upset that these things are slow, and they want to have more quick transfers between the countries. And so like a lot of policy things going on now about cross-border access to data. And they're looking at a amendment or an extension of the this cybercrime treaty to address cross-border access data to make it easier. We have a lot of concerns with that, that they'll make it too easy and won't have these checks and balances. But for like the on the, is it unusual that a country would be thinking about getting requests from foreign governments? It's not that unusual. And it in some ways sort of suggests that they are looking for some more mutuality, like they would do this, but of course the expectation is when you make it easier for foreign governments to get your information is that they will make it easier for you to get information, and everybody loses.
I'm going to purely speculate here. In addition to everything Kurt just said, which is 100% right and I agree with, there is a lot happening in foreign relations and international relations in this world right now, and the U.S. is making a lot of enemies out of people we used to be friendly with. And I think some countries and some governments are trying to figure out how to maintain their close ties and relationships with the United States. And for the years prior to this law being implemented, the Five Eyes countries met leading government officials, and they talked about this quote-unquote encryption problem. And it seemed like Australia wanted to be out in the lead in solving that problem for the other Five Eyes countries, including the United States. And I would not be surprised if this provision wasn't a direct show to the U.S. that we as a government can go and take advantage of this law in Australia, but also by virtue of that open themselves up to being used by other countries as well. Now again, that's pure speculation. I have no government documents to back that up, but we do see a lot of turmoil in that international relationships and trade space right now, and so having that be a show of good faith to the U.S. from Australia would not be outside the realm of possibility.
And let me just add an interesting fun fact is that when the Five Eyes met in Australia a couple years ago, they you know have meetings every year, that's when they sent out a message that said they wanted companies to provide them with backdoors or we may be forced to legislate on the issue. And you know, maybe just a coincidence that happened while they were meeting in Australia, and then Australia was the first to carry through with that threat. But they put it out there. You better give us what we want here, and they didn't get what they wanted. So here we are.
Question. Personally, I try to be as secure as I can, but it's sometimes kind of hard to keep track of what's going on with different apps, what's been discovered as far as vulnerabilities or changes of terms of use where suddenly the app makers are acting very suspicious. Does EFF have a list of recommended apps and things that people can use for iOS, Android, so on?
Well, I can direct you to a couple of things. So one is the ssd.eff.org. That is surveillance self-defense, and that is a series of guides on how to protect yourself online. It starts out with an exercise in threat modeling, so trying to determine what are the appropriate threats for you, and then sort of leads you through it. Like we don't have like a specific list of like endorsed product. In fact, what you should use maybe dependent on a circumstance. For example, Signal is a pretty good end-to-end encrypted messaging program, but in some countries, if you have Signal on your phone, that is itself suspicious, and it is a better trade-off to have WhatsApp on your phone, which is also an encrypted messenger service, but not in the least bit suspicious to have on your phone because everybody has WhatsApp. And it uses WhatsApp uses the Signal protocol. You need to do authentication is not as strong, but nevertheless, so what is the right thing to do will depend on your circumstances. But I would recommend checking out the ssd.eff.org to help us. And then there's a couple of things that are just really good ideas generally. We've hit on them, but why not hit on them again? Because they're really good. Update your software. That, a lot of other companies, especially mature, larger companies, are routinely putting out security updates. They, sometimes there'll be weekly ones when it's really hot. And by updating these things as quick as possible, it means that it's harder to get you. And you don't have to worry about whether you know that there was a vulnerability and it got disclosed and patched. You get the patch anyway.
How many of you have an IoT, an Internet of Things device in your home? My family has one. In fact, my sister asked me for an internet-connected slow cooker last year, and if she ever watches this video, she's going to kill me because I refused to buy it for her. Have some intentionality when you buy those things. Know what sensors are on them. Know what you're able to control remotely. And know all of those things are vulnerabilities. And so make a decision that you're letting that thing in your home and what could happen if it gets compromised. The baby monitor story, I think, is the best example of this, that had a video and audio, and people were piping into that to creepily spy on and talk to very young children. Those sensors were that you could make the decision that if that was compromised, that would be the result. Whereas maybe if you have an Internet of Things light bulb and they would just be able to turn on and on off your lights, you think that that would be an okay result of having that be compromised. You might not. But come at these things with a degree of intentionality and not just, this is a really cool thing I can control from my phone.
Of course, the problem is, of course, if you know what the sensors are, there's that thing recently, I can't remember where it is, I got Combrant, where they suddenly revealed there was a microphone in it. It was never disclosed before, and was it Amazon?
The cameras on planes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. They said, the microphone's going to be there for a future upgrade. We just put it in there and connected it up just in case. Just for the future. And never disclosed until it was discovered during the teardown, I think.
Yeah. Not everything needs to be connected to the internet.
It's probably obvious that this is suspicious, but I wanted to see if you guys had anything to add to this. All right, so countries that offer free internet at the airport.
Anybody that offers free internet.
As a general matter, the most secure thing you could do is, if you're going to use it, is use a VPN. And the first thing you do when you get on a sketchy Wi-Fi is use a VPN. And then the question is, what is a sketchy Wi-Fi? And at the airport, there can be definitely a sketchy Wi-Fi that's operated by the country. Also, there could be one where someone just sets up a wireless access point and calls it free airport Wi-Fi, and you connect to that, and it has nothing to do with the airport. They just sit around in the cafe and see the traffic.
Or free EF forums track Wi-Fi. I think we used to do that here a few years back, and we had a wall of sheep with all the people's usernames and passwords on the wall.
I think 10 years ago or so, there was a study saying that airport Wi-Fi was where the most people had their phones compromised more than any other location. It was in airports where people were able to compromise the most phones. So be airport careful.
Don't fly. Yeah.
But also an internet cafe, there may or may not be a compromise on the Wi-Fi, but why not use a VPN? So that's another one where it's a pretty decent trade-off. Is to have a VPN. They're generally not that expensive, $5 a month kind of thing. And you will be better off and better protected using sketchy Wi-Fi if you're on a VPN. Or if you're more sketched out, then don't use it. That's another option.
Torrentfreak.com does have a list of VPNs and their privacy policies and stuff.
I mean, I still think actually the VPN is still an issue because you're just changing who you're trusting. You're going from trusting the airport to operating the VPN. And yeah, you can totally look at their privacy policy, but you have no way of knowing whether they're going to abide by that.
There was that case recently, it was a few months back, where they said they didn't log or anything, and they turned out there was a case, I can't think of it. I have con brain already. But there was a case, can't think of which VPN it was. They said they didn't log, and then they turned over the logs when somebody high profile was hacked using them.
Yeah, this could happen, right? That they make a lot of promises, and it's hard to verify that. I mean, you can search around, you can find some recommendations online about some VPNs who are perhaps more trustworthy than others. But the key thing is just realize you got to trust somebody, and the question is who it is. And it may be that the VPN provider is better than, run a VPN out of your own house, secured by your team of highly dedicated professionals.
Okay, stuff. I guess we have time for just one last question real quick.
So I'm curious if there are any legal challenges available to this law in the Australian system remaining?
So maybe, and Kurt kind of addressed, we don't really know. But creatively, one of the things I'm really interested in, the ICCPR, which is the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, it's an international treaty on human rights. A lot of countries, most countries, are party to it. I'm talking really, really fast. There's a first optional protocol. I'm getting deep into human rights weeds right now. First optional protocol, which very few countries sign on to, that allows countries to have their implementation of that treaty challenged up to the UN. Australia has signed on to that first optional protocol. The US has not. And so there is a mechanism, if we get into the part where it is being used and a company wants to do so, where they can say this law and the Australian government's implementation undermines its human rights obligations under this international treaty that they have signed. This is going to be a last, like, Hail Mary pass, and we're never going to know if it's used by those companies, but I'm, like, pushing for it in every single platform I'm in because somebody's going to hear it, and they're going to look into it, and it's going to happen. And I just, like, take it with you and spread the word. ICCPR.
Okay, so we got a second or two, so... Final words, any quick points to point out? Key points to take away, rather.
A key point to take away? I think we hit a number of key points here. One is you should all do whatever you can to keep yourself secure, use encrypted communications, and try do your best for your own self-defense. Another is that Australia, bad. They did bad, and they should feel bad. Hopefully it will be challenged under the human rights law, challenged by the companies, or just economically challenged because companies don't trust Australian products anymore, don't want to bring their products to Australia, and maybe that will create a warning for others. And keep your eyes open for more information about encryption, and keep talking about it to your friends, to like spread the good news about encryption so that more people are caring about and aware of these issues.
The word crypto is shorthand for cryptography. That's this conversation. Don't use it to mean cryptocurrency. Thank you very much. Have a great day. This has been a public service announcement.
Thank you, and don't forget to rate us in the app if you enjoyed this panel. Thank you very much. Thank you.